is Irene Kurka, and I welcome you to my podcast, Neue Musik Leben. This is usually a German podcast, but once in a while I do English episodes, like today. I have studied classical singing, and I love to sing contemporary and experimental music. If you would like to find more about me and my art, please look at my website www.irenekurka.de. I will put this information for you into the show notes, and you could also subscribe to my newsletter on my website. In this podcast, I share with you everything all around new and contemporary music. I share with you inside knowledge, behind the scenes, and it is very important for me to bring the human beings out of the new music world closer to you. I'm cooperating with the NMZ, Neue Musikzeitung, which is a very important German music paper. And yeah, I hope you had a great summer. I'm preparing great pieces for September and the fall, like the folk songs by Luciano Berio and also the Beatles songs by Luciano Berio and so many other great pieces. I'm really, really excited and looking forward to all those great concerts, which you also find on my website. I'm also excited that I will sing on the 16th of September a concert in Cologne with new pieces for me and the Indian Shruti Box. Today I have an interview with the composer Lisa Lim. With this interview, it is for the Musikfest Berlin because Lisa Lim has two performances in this festival. The first piece is The Machine for Contacting the Dead. It is a German premiere on the 11th of September. And secondly, there will be a new string quartet, a premiere, String Creatures. And this will be on the 15th of September. You will find all the information in the show notes. Please go to the website of Musikfest Berlin and look at those concerts. We also have interviewed Enno Poppe in this podcast. You might also listen to this interview. And please look around on the website because I'm very sure that there are other great concerts. And if you're close to Berlin, go there and listen to it. Now let's get to the interview with Lisa Lim. Hello, Lisa. Lisa Lim, I cordially welcome you today into my podcast, Neue Musik Leben.
Wonderful to be here, Rena.
And at first, I would like to know, how did you find your way into new and experimental music?
I was very fortunate to go to a fantastic secondary school in Australia. It was an all-girls school, and it had an amazing music program that really highlighted contemporary music. And so I was writing my own music, experimenting with fellow students from the age of 11, and attending music classes where I heard things like Penderecki's Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima, work by Berio. Berio's Visage made a huge sort of impression on me, Cappy Barbarian's singing. And finding out about John Cage, I was a real fan of Yoko Ono as a teenager. So, you know, I kind of had a very natural and organic sort of connection to new music fairly early on. And the notion of making one's own music was something that was instilled also, you know, from those early teenage years. And I suppose that kind of early contact, I mean, it means that I'm super sort of dedicated to the notion that new music is something that should be introduced and studied, you know, in schools rather than being something that's kept until later. But that sense of the notion that any sound can be music, of listening as a primary access point to thinking about music and really a kind of early training in this listening and differentiation of the nuances of sound in the field around us was something that, of course, was extremely important to becoming a composer.
Well, that sounds really very lucky. And so when did you develop your own idea to become a composer? And also, as a woman, did you have role models already in Australia?
Well, yes, as I mentioned, the school was an all-girls school, and there were certain advantages in that, in that, you know, obviously the message was that girls could do any role. And yes, I began composing, or this notion of being a composer, making music pretty early. I mean, I was studying violin and piano and experimenting with, fellow students. I mean, you know, I worked with a singer, Deborah Kayser, when I was at school. I've known her since I was 13, and I continued to write for her, you know, making operatic works, well into the late 2000s. So sense of real continuity between those early experiences and, let's say, that whole path of being a composer. Yeah, so extremely fortunate. And in fact, that school produced other composers. So, you know, it wasn't a one-off.
Cool. And so for you also, as a woman, it was quite natural to become a composer?
Yes, I suppose. I didn't really think so much about the gender aspect and hurdles until rather later. Though, of course, in my so-called career as a composer, especially in the early days, every context, every concert, every festival that I was involved in, I would usually be the only woman, or definitely in the minority, and not just the only one, but the only Asian person also. And I think it was only rather later that I had enough vocabulary to articulate this kind of disparity. And it's been in more recent years that I've worked to really address this kind of inequity and gender disparity in my work as a teacher and as an advocate for women in music. And certainly the conversation has changed kind of quite mm-hmm. radically from, you know, personally from personal point of view in the last, let's say, I don't know, 7 to 8 years.
And I mean, I know that you're also teaching in Sydney at the conservatory. Yes. And do you have half-half male and women composers, or how is it over there? And how do you receive them? Or is it still a topic, or are they just relaxed, I'm a composer?
Yes, I think it is still a topic. Unfortunately, it is still something that one has to pay attention to and really deal with quite consciously. I actually run a program at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music, which is called Composing Women. It was set up as a postgraduate course specifically to address this problem, which is that at the beginning of undergraduate studies, there's composition studies that are available from the first year of undergraduate. Actually, the gender kind of split is 50-50. You know, it is actually equal when students come into the institution. And so the course that I run was really set up in response to data, and statistics are so important in terms of really getting a sense of what's going on, because at the end of a four-year course, the number of women involved had slipped. Number of women involved in composition, that is, slipped to 25 to 30%, and then at the postgraduate level, there was an absolute cliff face in terms of participation, and so women were disappearing. And what the problem wasn't really at the beginning, but more as one progressed along. And so certainly in the Australian kind of context, this idea of supporting women to build bridges into the profession was very important. I'm glad to say that actually things, there has been an impact, there has been traction, and that the picture is looking different now, 6 years into the running of this program.
Mm-hmm. But as you said, it looks like we still have to observe it. And you live a lot in Australia, or you teach there, but you have been all over the world and have been working all over. And what would you say? I mean, I haven't been to Australia yet. What is unique about the music scene in Australia, or the new music scene? or what? How does it differentiate from other countries?
Yeah, it's hard to sort of pinpoint, you know, as in terms of saying, okay, Australia's unique for certain things. For sure, you know, it has particular contexts and histories and lineages of practice and so on. But it participates in the wider world of let's say new music practices. I mean, something that's very significant in Australia is in recent times is increased participation of Indigenous composers and musicians in the sort of classical new music world. And that's been as a result of important programs like Ngarraburia, which is an Indigenous development program, and the work of various institutions. So that's an interesting and distinctive aspect of what's going on in Australia. And so, you know, the conversation around that, of course, is different than, say, in Europe. Yeah.
Oh, sounds really exciting. Cool. And what are the qualities you most appreciate in the performers you work with?
Oh, well, that's an easy one. So, I mean, I work with many really extraordinary and wonderful performers. And the collaborative relationship performers is really central to what I do as a composer. I'm always looking to work with, weave with, highlight what I think of as the grain of performers and their bodies and their embodied knowledge. A recent project that I've done whilst I've been here in residence at the Wissenschaftskolleg zu Berlin is with the Swedish violinist Karin Hellqvist. And I was very interested, and she was very interested because this is part of her PhD research in looking at the place of Swedish folk fiddle traditions in how she, in her whole makeup as a musician, you know, because she has been playing this traditional music since she was a kid, since she was six, and she's also, you know, kind of totally classically trained and playing a lot of new music. And she's collaborated with many, you know, important composers, of course, in Europe, from Karel Bocholt and, you know, so on and so forth. So, you know, what is the place of this embodied knowledge, the kind of the impression of the traditional music on her body and her understanding of music? We were looking at the place of the Swedish folk dance, the polska. And I actually did a workshop here at Vico in which we taught the audience in the seminar this polska dance, which has this a particular kind of triple rhythm. It's like there's a heavy step on the first and the third beat and a light step on the second. So it's a one, two, three, one, two, three. And when I talk about embodied knowledge, you know, you can talk about it, but unless you actually experience it in your body, you really don't know what it is. So teaching this dance to the participants and showing how one can go from prosaic everyday walking and the steps of walking into dance just by delaying the second step, you know, this floating suspended step. And this became the basis of an amazing sort of discussion, you know, about where does something begin to dance? And it's about hesitation or suspension or delay and the lyricism, the swing of that and so on and so forth. So this is what I really gain from performers, this kind of subtle, special, what I think of as secret knowledge. And it's for me the real joy of collaboration to come into contact with this type of information that flows into the kind of music that I'm making.
So then it's pretty specific because you really get to know the performer or know what they are or what they bring, and then you develop it in a way kind of together, or you talk about what both of you interests or you really have a fire for.
Absolutely. I really sometimes I think of it as a little bit like, I mean, something that's very common in dance, you know, where the choreographer really makes the dance on the bodies of the dancers. And there's definitely an element of that in how I work with performers. Really want to craft something very specific and and personalized, you know, because when something is personalized, you know, there's a fantastic energy that comes into the performance. And ultimately, it's this energy that I'm looking for, the sense of ownership, the sense of the voice coming through in the performance. And you might say, okay, you know, you make this work that's very specified for one performer or a particular situation. How does that translate, you know, afterwards?
Mm-hmm.
And I find this very interesting too, you know, and it goes beyond what can be captured in the score, and it's about performance practice, and it's how performers actually are creating, you know, when they create a new work, they are creating the new performance practice, and this can be transmitted. It's transmitted through live performance. It's transmitted through the documentation. I find videos really very crucial in how my music is, you know, kind of further performed by others. And this sense of, yeah, this participation of lineages is mm-hmm. kind of also important.
But I'm sure you also enjoy then when another performer maybe brings in something new or their own personality.
Yeah, definitely. This is really interesting because I think one can't know everything about the potential of a piece of music. You know, I think that's a basic mm-hmm. premise of art, that it's non-totalizable. You know, you can't completely, kind of use it up. So every manifestation is a kind of further mm-hmm. elaboration of the life of the work.
And so I also hear that for you, it's then important to know the interpreter, or have you written pieces where you didn't know who it was for, or is this like a prerequisite for you to do that?
That is the ideal. I mean, sometimes, you know, I'm working with very large institutions, for instance, writing for an orchestra, and of course you can't know, you know, all those performers mm-hmm. and the situation's very different to you know, you don't have the kind of time, the dialogue that you have with a soloist. But, you know, I also really enjoy working with these larger masses, and there the reflection is more on performance practice that come out of the sort of repertoires that the orchestra says is performing. And, yeah, maybe you say the occasion. There's still many clues, you know, because music belongs and exists in such contextual, you know, circumstances. So I guess, yeah, there can be sort of very personal contact, but also kind of weaving with the context of, mm-hmm. you know, of the situation you find yourself in. I mean, I find myself, I think I'm sort of quite transparent as a composer, where, yes, that's, I also work with abstractions, but there's also an element of wanting to kind of connect in kind of maybe more specified ways with things.
Mm-hmm. And since I'm a singer myself, I'm always curious when composers write for voice, how is that for you? And is it challenging? Because every composer has a different approach to it. I mean, there are also a few composers which I regret that do not want to write for voice at all.
Okay.
Some find it challenging and some find it easy because they sing themselves a lot. How is it for you?
Oh, well, I love working with, vocal performers, singers. And I've written, you know, five operatic scale works. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that kind of multidimensionality of opera is, of course, really exciting, and the ritual aspects of opera. But, yeah, voice, I mean, that for me is the most kind of personalized type of sound, you know, where you're really close to the body, the grain of the body and the sense of access, you know, to sort of emotional, psychological aspects in performance, and the heightened nature of that. For me, it's always so important, a kind of ritual dimension where one is stepping outside of the ordinary everyday and into sort of heightened states. And I think, you know, singers, vocalists really offer this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wow. And do you think we have prejudice against new music? And if so, what can we do to change it? And what are you doing to bring new music to a new or broader audience?
Yeah, that's a big question. Maybe I can just break it down a little bit, because I think new music is not a single monolithic thing. I think there is no longer a kind of single orthodoxy around new music. I mean, just thinking about where I am right now in Berlin, you know, there's so many different strands of activity, and, you know, a lot of stuff going on in different kinds of spaces with their own communities as well. And I think, you know, just because it doesn't reach a large number, it doesn't mean that it doesn't have value. And I think that sort of community building, even at a, say, smaller scale, is like absolutely essential and valuable. And we can't know everything about the value and who music reaches later. You know, I think there's a sort of long game to it. I mean, for instance, I mean, I think of a great figure like Elian Radig, you know, who's 90 now, and whose music was operating in let's say, you know, the sort of experimental music context and not necessarily, you know, widely known. And she's now this kind of massive cult figure. She had these amazing number of concerts dedicated to her music at the Metz Music. So, you know, I kind of want to stay in this sort of rather more attitude of like, let's see, you know, let's we don't have to necessarily make this judgment straight away. That's my kind of take on that.
Wow. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Music Fest. And I've seen, or I know that you have two pieces. One will be the Deutsche Erstaufführung, and one will be also a Deutsche Erstaufführung, I think, or is there a premiere? But you can tell us about what what's going to happen, or what kind of highlights or secrets you want to disclose about those pieces, or about the approach, or anything.
Yeah. So there are two pieces. One, the most recent piece, which I'm actually just finishing now, right? It's called String Creatures, for two violins, viola, cello. It's for the Jack Quartet. And it will have been premiered in Luzern, who commissioned the work just a month before coming to Berlin. So it's called String Creatures rather than String Quartet. So it's this notion, you know, quartet is like this sort of numerical designation, yeah. And I wanted to call it String Creatures more as a way of pointing to kind of the idea of music and music materials and music's connection to performers as something really living, you know, really more like creatures with their own kind of lives and you know, animacy and desires and voices. And so this work is, it's about 26 minutes long. It's in three parts. And I'll tell you the titles or the subtitles. It starts off with a shorter section called Cat's Cradle, Three Diagrams of Grief. And then another section called Untethered. And finally, the last part is called A Nest is Woven from the Inside Out. So it kind of plays with ideas of strings, and the sort of, you know, this kind of very ancient fiber technologies, you know, some of our oldest technologies about string and the way in which string enables us to bind and unbind and knot and you know, kind of catch things in the world. But also as a material, it allows us to imagine these kind of relationships, you know, it gives us a kind of model, you know, a diagram, like what is, since you pick up a string, you're starting to play with it. And this is, the Cat's Cradle refers to the children's game, you know, this game with string where you make these patterns. Patterns of string, this way in which strings entangle or a mess or loop, or, you know, it's a very rich kind of world. And so I play with some of these patterns in the piece and explore the way in which string enables us to think about time, to think about structure, and the way in which, yeah, the bodies of the musicians also kind of enact these kinds of, yeah, relations. Yeah. So, yeah, that's the sort of new piece. And, yeah, I mean, the Jack Quartet is so fabulous. There's so such fabulous musicians who just bring this incredible energy and openness to what they do. So, I'm really super excited to have that work in a program. I think it's with a program, Xenakis and Luckenman. So this is kind of cool, you know, kind of cool. And then the other piece is an old piece of mine. It's from 1999-2000, so, you know, more than 20 years ago. It's a very big piece I don't know, it's about 40 minutes, called Machine for Contacting the Dead, so which will be played by Ensemble Collective, Berlin-based, collective of ensembles. So I'm super excited by that. That's a piece I originally wrote for the Ensemble Intercontemporain in Paris. It's for 27 musicians. And it was commissioned it was kind of an occasional piece because it was commissioned to go with this exhibition in Paris of archaeological artifacts excavated from the tomb of the Marquis Yitzhak. So this is a tomb of this kind of nobleman 2,500 years ago, who was buried with an orchestra of instruments, 100, you know, kind of ancient instruments, particularly these gongs, which are very famous in China. They've been used ceremonially on a number of very important occasions, and replicas of them have been, you know, kind of used and shown. But what really caught my attention was he was also buried with his musicians, so 20 concubine, so women musician dancers were also killed and buried with him. So this is very, you know, kind of, as you might imagine, made a big impression, and so the work kind of deals with this notion of like listening to the voices of these kind of past musicians and these broken instruments, because there's this Chinese notion that grave goods should be transformed or broken in some way in order to be adequate or appropriate for the dead, for the spirits. And so the work, is kind of this imagining of this music. Of course, we have no idea what kind of music was performed, though, you know, what one can really see connections to current instruments. I mean, things like gongs, you know, very ancient instruments are still used today, and zither instruments and various kinds of other percussion and wind instruments. So, yeah, the work sort of, it's sort of a very large panorama of thoughts about, this kind of cultural world.
Well, thank you for sharing and all the insights. And I also will put then the dates and where it really will take place into the show notes, that, go there and listen to these pieces and to Lisa Lim. And, we already know about you that you're composing a lot, you're teaching, you're traveling, you're doing quite a lot of things. And I'm always curious how people do that. Do you have any kind of time management rituals, daily practices, or anything you want to tell us? Or do you even have a good advice for us how one can do all those great things or be creative?
Oh my God. I make lots of lists, and there's always something at the bottom of the list that never gets done. So that's probably like most people, right? You know, procrastination is part of the deal. I guess prioritization is important though. I don't really have a huge amount of advice in relation to time management, though I suppose I am pretty organized, otherwise I wouldn't get as much done. But perhaps another, a different way of talking about this is that actually we do live in incredibly complex temporal worlds now. I mean, this is very interesting for me as a composer, you know, quite apart from trying to manage that. As an artist, I'm very, very interested in the kind of multiplicity of temporalities that, you know, kind of challenge us and attack us and kind of undo us every day. And, you know, I think of, you know, everything that we've lived through in recent time, you know, pandemic time, you know, how bizarre is pandemic time with its weird stasis and blockages, and at the same time, you know, the anxiety of that, and at the same time the sheer boredom, you know, we hate it, the sense of being stuck. So the qualities of that time, you know, if I want to be kind of take a positive view, that's kind of quite interesting as a composer, the way in which things get stuck and glitch, and then, you know, kind of you loop back, and that's actually something I've been kind of interested in composing with. Then at the same time, sort of accelerations, you know, the news cycle and the sense that we're totally out of control. You know, the time is just rushing past in the weirdest sort of ways. Of course, climate change crises really bring this to the fore, you know, the Anthropocene, and many scholars have theorized on this Anthropocene, you know, time in which one is confronted with, you know, the deep time of species extinction and ecological kind of geologic kind of time that we've become so aware of, and at the same time foreshortening of futures. So, you know, also kind of from a kind of conceptual, you know, artistic point of view, this is kind of interesting. So I suppose, like, in terms of time management, maybe it's like turning it into an artistic project becomes one way of coping.
Yeah, observing everything. And do you have a specific time you compose, or can you do it throughout the day? Or some people are like morning people.
I mean, I'm kind of more late evening person. Yeah. So maybe I like afternoon's hopeless, you know. So afternoon is the time to do admin and have a walk and, you know, faff around. But yeah, I like to work late into the evening. I find there's enough, so a certain sort of calmness inside me allows me to get work done.
Mm. And what are you thankful for today?
Okay. You know, one of the things, I mean, I was talking about crisis I mean, we are faced with so many crises, particularly around environmental issues. This is something that I'm really quite doomy about. But I'm actually thankful that there is also an enormous amount of positive action and collective action that's happening in this area, and that things can still change really markedly and quickly. So that gives me hope. That there is still the possibility for sudden positive change, you know, that there are tipping points in within systems. So definitely tipping points absolutely towards complete disaster and so on. And that's very clear, as what every IPCC report has said, but also tipping points towards positivity. So I kind of cling on to that. And then sort of maybe at a more micro level, you know, because we still have to live somehow. I'm very grateful here, being here at in sort of the beautiful Grunewald, where you're surrounded by, very aware of this sort of changing seasons and seeing, you know, this inexorable livingness of plants and animals and insects and the sap, you know, the sense of the sap rising, which I really appreciated in this movement towards, you know, spring to summer. That has been, just wonderfully joyous. So, at a sort of micro level, I'm super joyous. I'm super sort of feel very connected to a sense of this joy of the livingness of things. Yeah.
And who or what has played the greatest role in shaping you, and what inspires you?
Yeah, it's hard to pinpoint. maybe it's not so much who or like the specific person, but something I've been reflecting on more recently is a really strong sense of being held by a kind of matriarchal lineage in my own family, a sense of this sort of ancestral line. So it's not just me, my mother, my grandmother, but something that's very deep. And I, in terms of sort of being inspired by, you know, I've really in recent works being expressing this sense of women's power, especially spiritual kind of energies in works like Sex Magic, which I wrote for Claire Chase. It's a work for contrabass flute and installation of kinetic percussions. I'm really looking at women's sort of spiritual power, but things like rage and topics like menopause and cycles of women's lives. So that's one sort of kind of a thing that's inspired. And then more recently, a work, a piece for a three-part work called Annunciation Triptych for orchestra. And that was also highlighting sort of three women spiritual icons: Sappho, Mary, Fatima. There was a work recently premiered in Cologne. So yeah, this sense of kind of women's lineage, I think, is something important to me, and it's manifested within personally, kind of within my family, but also, you know, like looking towards bigger kind of points of reference.
Mm. As a woman, I like hearing that to celebrate or show how wonderful we are. And what does it mean for you to be true or authentic to yourself in this music business? And how do you do that?
Yeah, I mean, I spoke earlier about the importance of collaboration and the kind of weaving with things that I encounter. So I guess that authenticity or trueness is kind of connected to certain openness and a feeling of freedom of the connections I can make, rather than a sort of more abstract aloofness, right? That one is somehow separate from things. So authenticity through a kind of openness of connection is I think something I'm aiming for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what does success mean for you?
I mean, connected to that, I would say this ability to have freedom to find those connections. So maybe freedom is a parallel world word for me for success.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything that drives you forward, or do you have kind of a vision? What motivates you?
I'm not so planned, you know. I kind of rely on serendipitous encounters. You know, when I see the things that have become very important for me, it's usually something unexpected, you know, unexpected meeting, or you happen to be, you know, somewhere right time, the right place, and suddenly a conversation or something becomes, you know, just grows into this incredibly important thing. So I can't say I didn't plan that much. And so what drives me forward might be just, again, this kind of curiosity, you know, and like looking out for for that kind of, yeah, that spark of connection.
Yeah.
But I think lots of artists are like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're probably like that. I don't know. Are you like that? Things happen, you know, kind of often by chance, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, things also coming to me, but as I mean, you described it already. For me, it's also then sometimes that at a point something clicks inside of me, and then I know I have to do this, or I have to follow this path or this project, and then I'm totally on fire.
Yeah,
like you are too. I'm sure, and I also enjoy. Maybe for me, as older I get, to trust what's coming to me and to kind of lean back. I think when I was younger, I maybe tried to control more or something, but it doesn't work. And so I let go, and something is coming to me, and then I'm like, oh, this is cool. And as you said, you never know when another interesting door opens up, and I also enjoy this uncertainty even more in my life.
I think there's a kind of you know, like one's intuition, you know, this gut feeling, this intuition, and you said, you know, things click and you recognize it. But I think you also have to prepare for that moment of recognition. So I wouldn't say it's all just openness, but I think there is also that element of working at your craft in order to be able to distinguish, you know, that moment. So there's a balance, I think, between a certain discipline on the one hand, and then this openness. Again, I'm not saying anything new there, but I think those sort of sides are do need to be held in some kind of some kind of balance. Yeah,
you always play with it. I mean, wherever you are, and I guess that's also then the fun of it, as you said, to maybe go more in that direction or there. And I guess that's what life is about.
Yeah, the fun of it's really important. If it's not fun, you know, why spend your precious time with it?
Well, I really enjoyed talking to you, and you already gave us, showed us and so many great things about you and your world. And I'm actually arrived at the last question, and I would like to know from you, which tip would you like to give a young artist?
Well, I guess that's related to what we were just talking about, you know, is to work on one's craft and one's discipline, and then also remain open. Maybe an interesting tip is to actually just stay alert to things which seem to be rather humble and small, you know, and insignificant. I've always been staggered by how something that didn't seem so significant can actually take on an extraordinary sort of level of energetic power. And by that I mean, when I say things which seem insignificant or humble, often they're things that you can only see at the corner of your eye, right? At the side of your eye. It's somehow in the peripheral, in your peripheral vision. And that really requires training, that you can even notice. So it's about noticing. And the reason why something at the periphery is important is because you have to turn your gaze in order to catch it. And that act of turning takes you out of your habits. And this is an incredible moment, I think, in one's creative practice is to kind of try and catch things which you can barely notice. So a practice of noticing might be a something to work with, I think, for any artist at any stage.
Oh, I will take it with me as well. I thank you so much, dear Lisa, that we could speak today. And I wish you a great time in Berlin and all great concerts wherever you are, and certainly at Musikfest Berlin. And see you around, and all the best.
Thank you so much, Irene.
This was today's interview. And this was an interview for Musikfest Berlin. The this was today's interviews, and this interview was for Musikfest Berlin. I really hope that this interview inspired you, and I'm looking forward to hear from you through Facebook or email. Thank you very much that you tuned in with me today, and I really hope that you liked it and that it inspired you. It would be great for me if you could take some time to recommend this podcast to your friends and colleagues, or even if you have the time to give me a good evaluation on iTunes. Thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irina.